grace.
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 Well, tonight is an exciting and a sad night because we are wrapping up the entire Old Testament. It's been a very long journey from January of 2017 until today. Quite a big amount of time that we've traversed the Old Testament. So no one could say we rushed through it. So we're in Ecclesiastes chapter 12 tonight. Last week, we ended with an encouragement and warning from Solomon, which applies to all, but which was specifically targeted towards young people. And that's also the target audience in chapter 12 with a specific reason. It does not mean it's not something that can be used to extrapolate the same wisdom for anybody, regardless of where you are in life. But it was particularly targeted at the young for a reason. And the biggest reason is because of the fact that they're at the beginning of their journey and they stand to learn the most and avoid the most and be steered towards the greatest expressions of what is worth your time in this fleeting time that we have, quote unquote, under the sun, right? So now chapter 11, verse 9, quite literally, as I said last week, serves as the pivot point of the entire book. So right at the very end of the book is where the pivot point is, where the shift changes. And as I also said last week, up until this point, Solomon has presented us a book filled with subjective views of what benefits mankind and what doesn't, what externally seems fair while we live out our physical lives and what does not, what collectively is foolish, fleeting, and without value as compared to what possesses real and lasting value. What Solomon is now encouraging is joy with caution, a living out of our lives under the sun with a view to the eternal consequences of the choices we make. Solomon often instructs us to busy ourselves with work which is both best suited to our skill set and which brings satisfaction and delight to our hearts, then to take the proceeds of that labor and eat and drink so as to enjoy the short time of our joy that is afforded us in this life. He presents this several times throughout the book as the gift of God to us. Now, Solomon is continuing with his encouragement, especially when we are young and have the strength and the vigor to make the most of it, but he cautions us to do whatever we do with a view to the fact that our actions are before the ever-watching view of God with whom we have to give an account. Now, interestingly, here Solomon draws the height of his attention, not just to our actions alone, but to the motivations behind them. This is the introduction to the book's conclusion, which drives our attention towards motives and actions which would best hold up under the scrutinizing gaze of our Creator. Now let's read Ecclesiastes chapter 11, verse 9 and 10, and then go right into chapter 12, because they really do flow. One is really a great segue into the other. So chapter 11, verse 9 says, "Rejoice, O young man, while you are young, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Follow the impulses of your heart and the desires of your eyes, but know that God will judge your motives and your actions." So you see motives there, right? That is even brought up before your actions, correct? Now, let me go and just drop something here. Not so much for you guys, but for anybody who may listen to this in the future. The reason why Solomon targets young men is, again, in keeping with the thoughts of God and the intentions of God in creation. God made the man the lead, and women were created to be their helpmate. So if anybody's going to have a direction in life, it was intended by God to be the man. The woman's direction is always to come alongside and help him with whatever his direction was. So that's why he's focusing on this. Are you hearing me? That's not to say that in today's world, where there is more single women than there probably have ever been on the history of the world, they can't derive truth from this that can help guide their life. But Solomon was speaking to the world that existed in his day, which was, by the way, his world, which was the Jewish people. And the Jewish people lived largely, though they weren't always confined in their actions to obedience to the law, their general society was set up by God himself, not by traditions of men, but by God. God is the one who set this up. And so Solomon is obviously going to direct his attention towards young men who are the head of homes, and therefore they're the ones that set the course of the direction of not only their own lives, but their wives and their children as well. Are you hearing me? So that's why that he says what he says. This is not due to some worldly type version of a patriarchy. This is based completely and rooted entirely in God's intention in creation, which is seen and reflected in the Jewish lives, because God's one that established the parameters of their social lives. So he says, "Rejoice, O young man, while you are young, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Follow after the impulses of your heart and the desires of your eyes, but know that God will judge your motives and actions. Banish emotional stress from your mind and put away pain from your body, for youth and the prime of life are fleeting. So," 12 verse 1, "so remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the difficult days come and the years draw near, when you say, 'I have no pleasure in them,'" meaning I have no pleasure in the things of God, right? Now, this verse was before its time. In that, by that I mean, today we know from doing in-depth social analysis across the board, not just in first world countries, but really everywhere you go, because humans are largely just humans, regardless of where they go, what ethnic group they grow up, whether they grew up in a small village in the middle of nowhere, whether they grew up in Manhattan and New York, people are people. And one thing that they have been able to determine, not just in Christian realms, but in other realms, Hitler's one of his more famous premises was the idea of, give me a child until the age he is whatever, and I'll own him for life. And the reason why is because the formative years are the years that sets the compass for the rest of your life. And we already know inside the church, inside the body of Christ, we have found statistically that if you don't come to Christ by the age of about 18, your chances of ever coming to Christ are diminished to down like to you're in the 10 to 15 percentile. Very, very low likelihood. Not impossible, but very, very low likelihood. Of course, those statistics can be increased or decreased based on other factors. Like if you happen to be married to a believer, your chances probably increase from 15% to maybe 25 or 30. Whereas if you are married to another atheist, you probably are down into 1 or 2 percentile. You see what I'm saying? There are other things that fluctuate and influence that number. But the big deal is if you haven't done it by the age of 18, you probably never will. Okay. So that's really in keeping with the statement, is it? He says, remember now your Creator in the days of your youth before. What is the pivoting line? When your attention has to be drawn away from what you wanted it to be on to what it has to be on. When you're a kid, you can do whatever you want to do for the most part, right? You can focus on what delights your heart, what you enjoy, even up into college. In the colleges, if you really, really are devoted to a particular field, that's where your interests, that's where your ambitions are. So you're still really in that phase yet, because you haven't started drawing a paycheck and having them pay for rent and cars and family and food with this knowledge. You're just obtaining the knowledge out of your pure interest and love for the field, right? But there's a day coming soon when the difficult days will smack you in the forehead like a 2x4. And from this day forward are the difficult days. And it's at that time that you declutter your life. You're like, I have time to be focused on this. I don't have time for this, this, and this. And if God was not already part of the this, he probably never will be. Are you hearing? So he says, remember your Creator in the days of your youth before the difficult days come and the years draw near when you say, I have no pleasure in them. This reflects back on and to God's judgment, not only of your actions, but your motives. Now, Solomon launches into a bit of a torrent of end-life metaphors. But I don't want you to forget for a second as we're going through them that they are all offered as warning statements to the young. Before, you know, to those people with whom life has just begun. Let me tell you about the difficult days before they come, right? I'm gonna give you some reason to listen, because I'm telling you, I told you, his beginning statement and his wrap-up statement are completely tethered together. I mean, there's a tight line between them. There's no wiggle room. But he fills in the gap between them with reasons why you need to listen now and pay attention to your creator in the days of your youth, because this is what the difficult days look like. So that's what he's about to go into, is a description of the difficult days as they are progressive in our lives. So starting in verse 2, it says, before the sun. So notice he starts off with before. So he's saying, pay attention to God now in your youth before. These are the difficult days. Before the sun and the light of the moon and the stars grow dark and the clouds disappear after the rain. When the eyes begin to grow dim, and once one piece of bad news seems to come quickly upon the heels of another, is what he's talking about here. When those who keep watch over the house begin to tremble. That phrase is essentially saying, when through increased weakness, the elderly find it harder to feel safe. When due to advancing age, their sense of courage and confidence in their ability to defend what is theirs has grown weak. And their bodies begin to tremble from that weakness or from the fear evoked from mindfulness over their weakness and vulnerability. I suppose this does not exclude the idea of trembling with anger over the increase of their inabilities as well, though I don't really think that's inherent to the thought that Solomon's getting here. I think he's starting off with, one of the first things that you begin to notice when the difficult days come is you're not as strong as you used to be. And that one of the first things you hear when people begin to recognize they're aging, I just can't seem to do what I used to do. They're not yet at the point of, you know, I just don't enjoy life anymore. I don't do this or I don't do that. Or I find myself recluse, drawing back and reclusing from people and from events. And I no longer take joy in this. You don't hear so many of those statements yet. It usually starts off with more benign statements like, I just don't have the energy I used to have. I feel weaker. I don't feel as strong. I don't feel as able, that kind of thing. That usually graduates to, wow, I get hurt easier than I used to get hurt, that kind of thing. You know what I'm saying? This is the progression of the thought. So he says, those who keep watch over the house begin to tremble because of their vulnerability. And the virile men begin to stoop over. Now, this was an interesting phrase. It took me on a little bit of a journey. There are several possible interpretations of this, but only one seems to really fit the points that are being made by Solomon. The idea could mean when stronger men begin to loom over what is yours, offering a sense of insecurity and knowing that if they pressed their advantage, you'd be helpless. Okay, that's one of the things it could mean, all right? And that's not entirely out of place. But this could also include, because he's talking to the young man, that he could be referring to vulnerability in the relationship that you have with your wife and maybe even your daughter. You may no longer be able to protect them against the virile man. Okay? Are you following me? Okay? The word virile can mean, someone who is sexually aggressive and strong-natured in that regard. But it's not limited to that meaning. But it's one of the meanings. So because of a couple other words that were brought up, it led me down that rabbit path. But I found that that's probably not consistent with what Solomon's talking about. But it still could fit, because the idea is the things that happen to you as you get older and you become susceptible to. Okay, so thus the difficult days. That would definitely fit, but I really don't think it's what Solomon was getting at. But I'll just go ahead and work you through the rabbit path of what I went down through when I thought about it, because this sprang to mind only due to the fact that these two words are used in immediate proximity to one another, that have a sexual reference, which is to stoop over or bend over. And the very next phrase we haven't read yet, which is grinding. Both of those two words are used together in the book of Job. My mind immediately went to Job when I read that phrase and this vulnerability for this man as he's getting older. This might be talking about his inability to protect his wife against someone who's aggressive against them, or his daughter, you know, because I'm going to read it to you in Job chapter 31, verse 9 through 12. If my heart has been if my heart has been enticed by a woman, or if I have lurked at my neighbor's door, meaning in other words, longingly to commit adultery against my wife, then the right judgment for me would be, then let my wife grind for another and let others bow down over her, which is a reference to sexual intercourse with someone other than someone else. So bend down over and grind, used together as a sexual reference. So those two words being used in this passage made me think that might be what this is referring to. See where I got it from. Are you guys tracking with me or not? Okay, verse 11 in Job 31 says, "For that would be wickedness. Yes, it would be an iniquity deserving of judgment. For what would be a that would be a fire that consumes to destruction and would root out all of my increase." So thus vulnerability, right? So Job's saying, you know, if I've had it in my heart to commit adultery against my wife, then the just judgment of God would be for my wife to commit adultery against me, right? That would be something that would vex me beyond being repaired from, right? And so that it indicates the idea of vulnerability and susceptibility, which fits in with what we're talking about with Solomon in this verse. So you readily see that the idea of grinding and stooping are used in a sexual context here in Job, and that is... it's highlighted as a grievous sense of loss. So in that way, it would definitely fit the point Solomon is making, in that it is one of vulnerability, fear, anxiety associated with age, and a personal lack of defensive strength. However, nothing else in this text implies anything sexual. And so it is in keeping with the best practices of textual analysis to assume the literary connection is imagined and not real. It's the thing I was connecting with Job is probably not present in this text, okay? And the reason why I bring that up is because, again, I've really gone through great pains as we started in Genesis, progressively we got to this last chapter in the Old Testament to help teach you how to study, okay? Are you hearing me? And learning that is a big deal. In the reason why I had to discount that possibility is, first, it sprang to my mind immediately, unbidden, because of my immediate remembrance of those words used in that context in the book of Job and the vulnerable nature of the situation. That's why it sprang to my mind. But just because it sprang to my mind, it would fit the example that Solomon is using, that's not enough to interpret it as that being what Solomon's talking about. Now I need to take a step back and look at the text, look at it in context, and know something about Solomon's writing style, know something about Hebrew poetry, and apply that to this and see, is there any justification just beyond the fact that these two simple words have been used in another place to refer to something sexual? Does that mean it means that here? So I'm saying I have to apply other things to look at the text and understand that. That's just being a good student of the word, which every child of God is called to be. I said every child of God is called to be a good student of the word. You need to be such a good student of the word that you have no reason to be ashamed of the interpretations you've come down to. Are you hearing me? Okay. That doesn't mean you're not going to come to a wrong conclusion from time to time, but at least you arrived at it honestly. Amen. Okay. That God's looking more at that, which is motive, than action. Right? So just playing on an aspect of this chapter. So that's what I did here. I like I said, I only mentioned it because the idea immediately popped off the page for me due to the wording in Job. And so I figured it may not be the only one. So I thought I would address it. So one of the first objections I had to this is the tenses. When the passage mentions grinders, it does so in the plural. So that's, it would not just refer to one, to your one wife. It referred to many wives. So that already gives me reason to give pause. That probably isn't referring to a sexual reference. Okay. If it had appeared in the singular, it could imply a sexual, deviance in the wife due to growing impotence in her husband. But the plural lays that to one side. The other issue is that Hebrew poetry, when a writer wants to imply a sexual subtext, they're almost always they almost always use a cluster of overlapping terms to make it very clear that's what they're getting at. And that's not used here. And so therefore, because it's not super clear and he's not using overlapping terms, it gives me another reason to think that's probably not what Solomon was getting at. Oh, you see what I'm saying? Yes? Okay. Finally, the subject of the verse would require a shift, and this is the big one, a shift from the vulnerable elderly person to the young virile person. It would no longer be about the person who's weak, but about the strength of the other guy. Are you hearing what I'm saying? All the way up to this point, every point that's being made, both here and afterwards, are all pointing to the vulnerability of the aged. If this verse, out of the blue, shifts to the strength of the younger man in the life of this elderly man, then your attention, the main character of the story is now shifted to somebody else. That's not consistent with Solomon's writing. It's not consistent with the flow of thought, and it's not consistent with Hebrew poetry. So I have to remove that as my possibility. So now I know for a fact this is not a sexual reference. It's actually just talking about that the vulnerability that you've developed over time because you, young man, used to be the virile, strong person, and now you become the weak person. It's all talking about one person, not two. Are you seeing what I'm saying? I didn't lose anybody. Okay, so can you see how examining this and taking a step back and seeing the flow of thought and so on is very, very important. The tenses gave me a clue. We went from singular to plural. The fact that I would have to change the main protagonist of the statements away from the elderly to a young and virile person, that's not consistent. Too many things made this, the idea that this is a sexual reference, a forced idea. And so you just eliminate it. Is everybody following? So again, I understand that's a sidestep from the flow of what we're learning tonight, but not really, because again, if you teach a person to fish, right, then you can do this on your own. And that's really the big deal. That's what I really want. That's one of the biggest takeaways of our whole trek through the Old Testament in the first place, and the greater part of the Bible, is that you might learn how to fish on your own. So finally, the subject of the verse, again, like I said, would require a shift. So what does it mean? Well, the most obvious would be that the virile man would be the elderly man in his youth, who has now begun to stoop and bend over like one who must use a cane to get about. The reason why I didn't immediately gravitate towards this conclusion is because the word virile carries the idea of wealth, influence, and even military strength. And so I thought, knowing that, I thought, well, this probably isn't talking about the young man who's gotten older, because nothing in the text suggests that he's wealthy, influential, or has been in the military. So I excluded that at the word go and immediately gravitated towards the sexual. But the word can mean, the word virile can mean just physically strong. Okay. And very likely that's therefore what this means. So in this case, it's the best practice to assume this is only a poetic description of the waning strength of the aged. Okay. Now, I know that was a lot to cover one verse, but again, I was trying to instruct you about how to study in the middle of it. That's why I went into all that. The next statement gets to the grinders part. It says, and the grinders, plural, begin to cease because they grow few. Here is the grinding phrase I mentioned earlier. With the removal of the possibility of a sexual subtext, this has to be broadening the landscape of the metaphor to include those in the life of the age growing fewer and fewer. One thing that you notice as you get older, you have less and less friends because more and more of them have died. Okay, you don't have as many. It's slimmer pickings all the time. Okay, and so it says here the grinders begin to cease because they grow few. Okay, it is a possible double entendre in that Literal grinders are those who mill grain under the grinding wheel or millstone, but it can also be used in a figurative sense of molar teeth, which also begin to get fewer and fewer the older you get. And I think this is literally the two things that Solomon was getting at. We see double entendres used throughout these verses, where he says something that could be interpreted one of either way, and both of them really kind of apply to the elderly. And he kind of does it, I think, probably to be clever and raise an eyebrow, maybe get a smirk out of a person, and therefore also maintain their attention. So I think he's talking about both here. And I'm not sure why it made me laugh when I discovered that, but some things, you know, can be conceptually funny. They're not really funny in real life. It's not funny to lose molars, but it's funny to consider that's probably what he's talking about. And then the next part of the verse says, and I want you to notice also the and statements here are progressive. A little bit later on, he shifts from the word and to or, which is not progressive. It's using this or that or that or that, okay? So these are all progressive states, talking about as you get older and then older and then older. So he's using these and statements. And those who look through the windows grow dim. Now, the words grow dim are used in other places in Scripture to depict failing eyesight in the elderly. And while it may mean that here, I believe the main force is more regarding interests in life outside of your life. I believe that because eyesight was the very thing Solomon mentioned in verse 2, so to mention it again here seemed like a waste of a metaphor. Why would you talk about the same thing twice? Because he brought up eyesight very early on already. To bring it up a second time just to refer to eyesight alone doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So there must be a broader sense in which he's referring to the dimness of the windows you're looking through. And I believe very much so that it's a double entendre that growing dim clearly includes eyesight, but is more pointed toward dimming interest in external affairs that you'd see outside your window. All right. To see if my thoughts were kind of on point here, and are naturally supported by the text itself, I submitted this thought to AI overview of the text, and this is what they said. The phrase, those who look through the windows grow dim, in Ecclesiastes 12:3, uses a highly specific cultural image. In the ancient Near East, women or servants would look out of the latticed windows of a house to engage with the public life of the village, watch festivals, or see who was passing by. Therefore, when lookers grow dim or few, it carries a heavy double meaning, just like I thought it did. The biological layer, the physical eyes are beginning to fail. Well, we know that. The second one is a social psychological layer, psychological layer. The aging person is withdrawing from society. The windows are no longer a portal of curiosity, connection, and engagement with the community because of physical frailty, fear of the streets, the diminishing physical senses. The older person retreats further and further inward into isolation. The outside world ceases to matter as much as it did to them at one point. The climax of disinterest. Your idea, because I typed this in as a question, so it's quoting what I said. Your idea of waning interest is explicitly confirmed just two verses later in verse 15, which summarizes this exact psychological state when it says, and desire no longer is stirred. The Hebrew word for desire here refers to appetite, passion, and the drive to experience life. So, evidently, I was on point. Okay, so this the statement here of I got to back up pretty far to get there. And those who look through the windows grow dim refers not only to dimming eyesight but dimming interest in what you can see in the outside world. Verse 4, and the doors along the street are shut. Now, this for me is a difficult metaphor. The doors are said. I didn't get this one on my own. I'm just going to tell you. I kind of, for some reason, and I can't tell you why, and maybe it was the Holy Spirit, I don't know. In my head, I kind of I kind of thought, because we've been working through the physical body as one expression and then a social or emotional expression to the same thing in almost every one of these, like the eyes and interest of what's outside, two for one reference. So I thought, well, maybe this has a physiological thing that it means as well as an external social thing it means. And for some reason, the idea of ears came to my mind, but I can't tell you why. But evidently, that's in keeping with what a lot of people who seem to know a whole lot more about Hebrew and Hebrew poetry said about it. So I'm going to think that maybe they may be right. The doors are said to represent the hearing, which would flow in flow in the developing context. But the verbal imagery of along the streets is the part that's lost on me. However, other translations render it as doors to the streets. And this seems more in keeping with the direction of flow of Solomon's point. Instead of saying doors along the street, it says doors to the street. Well, that makes sense to me. Do you follow what I'm saying? If, in fact, the doors is talking about the doors of your ears, doors along the street don't make any sense to me. Because I don't have ears all the way along the street. I have doors to my house that I can open to see and hear the outside world. I don't have doors along the street. Is anybody following me? Okay. Because up to this point, the only metaphor has been a house and a person. Right? Now, that house is in a neighborhood or is in a city. And so there's been references to what's going on outside the house. But all the references have been physical and about the house they live in. I can't defend my house anymore. I'm looking through the windows of my house. Therefore, the door of, not the doors down the street, but the door of my house. Is everybody seeing? Yeah. I just want to make sure I haven't lost anybody. Because what lost me was the particular version I was using, which said the doors are shut along the street. So I'm beginning to think, okay, this is a social thing. So who in their neighborhood is closing the door along their street? And why has that got anything to do with this guy aging? So I was having a disconnect. But when I realized that other translations say the door to the street is closed, that made sense. Because that's the door to my house or closed to the street outside my house. Now it made sense. Can you see why it made sense to me now? Okay, but it lost me at first. So this is likely, again, dual in nature, as so many of the preceding examples are. Both the hearing is suffering in terms of acuteness, but so is interest in what is being said. The next phrase stays with the hearing metaphor, but presents us with a conundrum, which in some ways confirms our assessment so far. For while it hints at hearing, which is getting worse, it also reveals how startled an aged person become over the simplest of noises. Okay? So this is the statement, end of verse 4, beginning of verse 5. When the sound of the grinding mill grows low, and one is awakened at the sound of a bird. So that seems like a bit of a conundrum. I can't hear someone grinding outside my own house in a grinding mill, but the whisper of a bird outside my door wakes me up. They seem like they contradict one another. Are you hearing me? So that's the first thing that came to my mind. And all their songs grow faint, and they are afraid of heights and dangers in the street. So there's a lot here. The sound of the grinding mill may be a hint, believe it or not, at familial loneliness, meaning loneliness for family. In Solomon's day, the grinding mill was often attended by women working together. Obviously, this would indicate and include an environment where there was probably a lot of talking, even singing. In ancient cities, the daily sound of accompanying women grinding grain at the millstone was a sign of a bustling and vibrant household. So in context, a low sound would suggest a house that has grown quiet, unproductive, and empty over time. So it's kind of sad, right? You don't hear the little footfalls of your children or the grandchildren. They don't visit as much as they often once did. And life has grown kind of solitary, okay? It is suggested by Guzik that the word of The sound of birds stirring from sleep points to the light sleep of the elderly and the tendency to awake at dawn to the singing of birds, not to their actual singing because you heard it, but because when you wake up is when they're also waking up and singing, okay? He also suggests that the sound of music represents a decreased interest in and appreciation of music, song, and singing, though I have to admit that that really hasn't been my experience with the elderly. If anything, I've kind of noticed the opposite with the elderly, at least if they're presented with music. Now, they may not express interest in music enough to go turn it on themselves, but if it is on, a lot of times I see elderly people engaging with it excitedly. So I'm not sure if I agree with Guzik here or not. It's on that's part of the beauty of these statements. Whether we're spot on with the analogies or not, what the metaphors strictly mean, we're really not in much danger because all of them are clearly talking about what happens with the progressiveness of age. So we still get what Solomon was aiming at, even if we don't nail down the metaphors and what he meant by them, right? We're still on the right track, one way or the other. Now, heights here are probably a reference to becoming fragile, where the smallest fall could break a bone. And we know that is definitely true with the elderly. And life becomes more preoccupied with fear over safety than the ability to abandon yourself to simple pleasures. Isn't that right? I mean, people that are elderly used to just be able to go about and not think much of it, you know? And now they are very, very preoccupied about, where's my walker? Help me down this step. I don't want to fall off of my chair. If I fall off my chair at my age right now, I'm probably not going to get hurt very bad. Now, if I fall off a ladder, I'll get hurt. I didn't get hurt in my youth. So it's progressing. But there's a day coming where falling off of a chair could break a hip as you get older, right? So, and you become more and more progressively concerned about things like this, and rightly so. You'd be just irresponsible if you weren't. And so I think that's kind of what they're getting here. The next statement goes on to, the almond blossom grows white, the grasshopper drags itself along, and the caper berry shrivels up, because man goes to his eternal home, and the mourners go about the streets. So you see this whole thing is progressing from youth to the time that you're pushing up flowers, right? The almond blossom growing white is likely a reference to gray hair. The grasshopper dragging along, pointing to decreased vigor in the elderly. Because grasshoppers are known not for dragging themselves along, but for hopping from place to place to place to place. And if they begin to drag themselves along, you know, the end's pretty close for this grasshopper, right? And I think that's really the analogy that they're getting at here as well. And caniper berries drying up very likely refers to two things, and this does apply. To the wrinkled appearance that you get as you get older, and to a greatly diminished sexual appetite, since caniper berries were very, very, very commonly used in Solomon's days as an aphrodisiac, something that would stir up sexual desire, which sexual desire diminishes with age. So it's saying you begin to become a shriveled up prune, and the things that, you know, your vim and vigor is gone in almost every arena of life. That's what it's getting at, okay? Before the silver cord is removed. Now, I remember reading this in my youth and giving up on the text because I was already kind of lost in the metaphors we've already read. But then when I got to the silver cord and the golden bowl, I'm like, all right, you've lost me. I mean, you're not giving anything to really work with here. What is it? What silver cord of what? What golden bowl are you talking about? You talking about a golden bowl in the tabernacle or a golden bowl that most people didn't have golden bowls? What are you talking about? So at this point, I just kind of shut the Bible when I was a kid because I'm like, I don't follow this. Now in my older age, it just kind of sprung right off the page at me. Before the silver cord is removed and the golden bowl is broken, or we've gone from and to or, okay? Or so when he's talking about the silver cord and he's talking about the golden bowl and he's talking about the pitcher, he's still talking about the same thing. He's just using a different analogy, okay? So before the silver cord is removed, or if you like, the golden bowl is broken, or if this makes more sense to you, the pitcher is shattered at the well, or the water wheel is broken at the cistern. Any of these type of the exact same thing. And the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the life's breath returns to God who gave it. So we're already at the end. The curtain's pulled, right? So verse 6 culminates in the end of life imagery. So all interpretations, regardless of what your spin is on these things, they all have got to fit in end of life paradigms. They all do. Or you're not going to get the gist of what he's saying. Now, it's interesting how all of these analogies regard water as the invigorating property of life. It makes me wonder of the deeper meanings associated with water throughout scripture. Particularly, two that sprang to my mind were those referencing natural birth and spiritual rebirth. Jesus, if you remember, when talking to Nicodemus, said that a man must be born both of water and the Spirit in order to enter the kingdom of God. Water most likely representing the water breaking often associated with the birth of a child. And, of course, the Spirit referring to the rejuvenation of the human spirit by the Holy Spirit at the new birth, right? So you can't be born again if you're not a human, and you can't be human if you haven't been born of a woman. So you have to be born of water and of the Spirit. And you see the same thing in 1 John in some ancient manuscripts. The earliest manuscripts don't have it. But in later manuscripts, it says that there are three that bear witness in heaven, and there's three that bear witness on earth, the Spirit, the Word, and the Father. And then on earth, there is the Spirit, the water, and the blood, the water representing human birth, okay? So there's three things that bear witness. So this water thing crops up several times in Scripture as associated with human birth. Or the fact that you are a living human being, therefore it's being brought up here that the water is broken, you're dying, right? You're no longer holding any water. You're returning to dust, which is patently devoid of water, right? Okay. Now, Isaiah draws a connection between the Spirit and water in Isaiah 44, verse 3, when he prophesies, "For I will pour water on him who is thirsty and floods on the dry ground. I will pour my Spirit on your descendants and my blessings on your offspring." Associating Spirit with water and dry ground with death, you know. So, I mean, the person who's thirsty or about to die. These are all pitted against the dryness of dust to which we will return once our life under the sun has run its course. Now, there are many suggested understandings of what the silver cord or the golden bowl represent as metaphorical references, but they all point to the same idea, and they both have to be in some way associated with water, because clearly the last two definitely have water and the idea that you're returning to dust, so which is dry. So they all have some connection. What it is another issue, but they're connected in some way. It is suggested that the silver cord represents that which tethers the Spirit to the human body. When it's loosed, the Spirit leaves the body. And when that happens, of course, you begin to progressively work towards dust, right? So that's what ties the two together, gives it life. And that the golden bowl represents human consciousness. I'm not so sure that I really buy the idea of human consciousness, because you're continuing to be conscious after you die. So if it does represent human consciousness or awareness of particularly of God, which would be the source of water or life, living water, it would have to do with the fact that as soon as you die, your paradigm shift is going to be huge. I don't care whether you're born again or not. The greater world that's existed behind the world you knew will become immediately open to your view. And you're going to realize how much been going on behind the scenes that's always been there and you were blind to it. So if anything, if it's referring to human consciousness, it's talking about a defibrillation of or an expanding of your consciousness, not a cessation of it. Are you hearing? Okay. So meaning, in other words, therefore, the brokenness of the bowl would not be the end of consciousness, but rather the breaking of its limitations. you're no longer bound to the things that you view while you're under the sun. Now you see things that go beyond that life under the sun. Okay. The last two analogies being the pitcher is shattered at the well and the water wheel is broken at the cistern. Both clearly metaphors of water. That all of the above examples are pointing to the same eventuality is clear, since they are all or statements rather than progressive statements, you know, this, then, that, or this and that. All of these end in returning to the dust and the spirit returning to God who gave it, which points back to Genesis, where God made man out of the dust of the earth and breathed into his nose the breath of life. So when life ends, your life goes right back to the guy who gave it to you, right? Your spirit. Verse 7, the dust returns to the earth as it was, and life's breath returns to God who gave it. Now remember that all of the above will remember your creator in the days of your youth statements, right? Before the slow, inevitable march back towards your creator begins, right? In earnest. Solomon then repeats his often refrain throughout this whole book. Because he started off with, remember your creator in the days of your youth before the difficult days come and the years draw near when you say I have no pleasure in them. Let me explain what those days look like. Then he says, these all are end in the silver cord being broken, severed, the golden board being broken, the pitcher broken, the cistern broken as well. And the spirit returning back to God who gave it and your body returning to dust. Then he says, absolutely futile, laments the teacher. All of these things are futile. So he's been saying that the whole time. He reinforces it now. Meaning, in other words, but now it's being viewed through a little bit of a different lens. Which he already introduced at the end of chapter 11, and he brought up at the first one in chapter 12, which is mindfulness of your connectedness with your creator. Regardless of who you are, whether you are in covenant with God or not, you're still connected because we're the work of his hands. And your spirit's going to return right back to him who gave it, and that's the moment you're going to be judged. Right? So, bearing this in mind, right? When he says all of this is futile, what he's getting at is everything that you do under the sun, in and of itself, if it's not connected with remembering your creator and living a life of connected with your creator is absolutely futileness. It means nothing. All the numbers add up to zero or a negative figure. Right? So absolutely futile, laments the teacher. All of these things are futile. Not only was the teacher wise, but he also taught knowledge to the people. He carefully evaluated and arranged many proverbs. The teacher sought to find delightful words and to write accurate, truthful sayings. Now, delightful words means things that would make you think. Things, thoughts that might intrigue you and captivate your attention enough to pay attention to what he's saying, right? It's the same thing that movies do. Most people have come to the point where they realize that most writers, most movie makers and directors have worldviews. And that is what they use their movies to portray and to force upon the public. And the way they get you to listen is by giving you visual eye candy and storylines that captivate you long enough for them to slip their point in unnoticed. Okay? They do this on purpose. They're preachers. That's what they do. And God help them, because a lot of stuff they're teaching is God awful. It's horrible. But that's what they're doing. And they'll tell you so. If you ever listen to people who wrote a TV series or wrote a movie or a series of movies, they're completely behind whatever it was that was the sub point of this entire, the sub point is the point. That's the whole thing. That's the whole reason they made the whole movie, you know? And so, I mean, like anybody who's enjoyed the whole Avatar movie, it's all about conservation and tree hugging and love the earth and quit destroying it, you terrible humans, because everywhere humans are, we destroy everything. That's what the whole mantra is about, hug a tree. It's about environmental friendliness. It's about use paper straws, not plastic straws. That's what the whole movie is about. And you can watch the whole movie and not necessarily pick up on it until it gets to key points. But that's the only thing he was aiming at. He didn't really care about the other stuff. Now, being the guy that created the movie, he cared about the visuals. It was very important. That's why he waited so long to make it, because he needed to have the technology that could do it justice. But he wanted to sell a point that he was making. And he was making the same point in both movies. Okay, so my point being that this is what people do. And so Solomon, it says that's what Solomon was doing here. He says, the teacher sought to find delightful words, captivating words, and to write accurate, truthful sayings through them. Now he says, the words of the sages, plural, not talking about himself, but sages, plural, are like prods, and the collected sayings are like firmly fixed nails. They are given by one shepherd. Here Solomon seamlessly mixes both carpentry and husbandry language together. Everything I'm saying, Solomon's saying here, to you is like goads used to guide sheep. Goads, if you remember, are like sharp sticks or like the spurs on boots that they use to spur on horses. You know, they're goads. They're intended to get their attention and get them moving, okay, to guide them in a certain direction. Everything he's saying here, he says, I'm saying to you, is like goads used to guide sheep and are as fixed, sure, and reliable as well-driven nails are for constructing a house. Therefore, his next words are, be warned, which is an altogether better way than saying, listen up. Because the reason I want you to listen is because this is a good warning. Again, to who? You young men, right? Who's who he started with, right? Verse 12, therefore, you could just superimpose that on that. Therefore, young men, be warned, my son, of anything in addition to them. There is no end to the making of many books, and much study is exhausting to the body. I think Solomon is saying that anyone who attempts to make more of life than what I have stated so far, or which leads to a lesser conclusion than what I'm about to set before you, is not worthy of your attention. I'm warning you, don't waste your time on it. You can study every book ever written and consult all the sages that exist on the earth simultaneously, and every religious text and every proverb the world has ever produced. And though you will exalt yourself with its effort, you will be none the wiser beyond what I'm telling you. I think that's what he's getting at here. Verse 13, having heard everything, I have reached this conclusion. Fear God and keep his commandments, because this is the entirety of the duty of man. Well, that's a short list. Everything in your life that is important and that is going to be the thing, the tallying point for which I give an account at the end of life, can be summed up in two things. Fear God, which means deeply respect him, and obey him. That sums up everything you are put on this earth to do. And if you add to that or take away from it, you're a fool. Well, those are strong words. But, you know, that boils it down to something even I can put my head around. Right? The list isn't long. Two. Right? Respect God deeply. And obey what the man says. And truth of the matter is, if you did one, you would do two. Right? Yes. Right? Yes. I'd obey him if I truly respected him. So just really, just respect him. Right? Now, this includes the motivations. This includes the motivations behind our actions is clear from our opening verse. Because it said, you know, the motivation and the actions. Right? But it's also confirmed with two other passages, which are what I'm going to close with. One of my favorite ones is here in Micah chapter 6, And I have to give my father credit because this was his favorite verse. And once I learned it was his favorite verse, it quickly became one of mine. It is a great verse. And it's another summary verse, like the one we just read from Solomon, only it's got 3 points rather than just two. But it says the same thing. So in Micah chapter 6, verse 3 through 8, it says, "O my people, what have I done to you? And how have I wearied you? Testify against me. For I brought you up out of the land of Egypt. I redeemed you from the house of bondage. And I set before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. O my people, remember now what Balak, king of Moab, counseled, and what Balaam, the son of Beor, answered him. From Acacia Grove to Gilgal, that you may know the righteousness of the Lord. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before the Most High? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with 1,000 rams, 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul?" He has shown you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? But to do justly, love mercy, and to walk in humility with your God. What an invitation. Endgame is, go back to the garden, walk with me in the cool of the day in humility. This is what I want from you. I want humble communion with you. Because even though you're made in the image of God, you're not God. I know your tendency because you're like me and you've got eternity in your heart. You can sense the gravity of your own self-value. And you can, through a distortion of understanding, think, therefore, your opinion is on par with mine. But it's not. I want to make you like me, so come and walk with me and learn of me, right? And I will make you like me. Because the potential is there. So do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. In other words, do what is right. Walk mercifully with those who stumble and don't do what's right. Don't be judgmental of yourself or other people. And walk in humility with the God that you love. Well, that's just solid advice, isn't it? That's just really, really good advice. And it sums up exactly the way Solomon did. He has shown you, O man, what is good. Now, the other one is in Hebrews chapter 4, verse 11 through 13. It says, "Let us therefore be diligent to enter that rest." What rest? Well, it's described in different language in Hebrews. But it really does kind of fit the same thing we just said of doing justly, loving mercy, and walking in humility with God. There's a rest to that kind of life. You realize that if you know what God says that he expects out of you, that takes a lot of pressure off of you. You don't have to come up with what to do. Now you know what to do. Hello? Most of the big pivoting issues that make people lose sleep at life would be gone if you just respected him, respected his word, sought his face for his face and not just for his advice and his help, and then walked humbly with him. I mean, you would literally enter into the rest, right? And that's just a blessed place to be. "Let us therefore be diligent to enter that rest, lest anyone fall short according to the same example of disobedience. For the word of God is living and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the division of soul and spirit," right through that silver cord we mentioned earlier, "piercing even the division of soul and spirit and joints and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and the intentions or motivations of the heart. And there is no creature hidden from his sight, but everything is naked and open to the eyes of him to whom we must give an account," which is the point of the entire last chapter, right? So I thought those were two good, very good summary statements that capture what Solomon said. So that's it. We're done with the Old Testament. And we're done with the book of Ecclesiastes. But does anybody have any questions about the development of thought or how it concluded or whatever that may pop to your mind?
Verses came right earlier when you were talking about I'll just say the verse. Anyway, it's about where your treasure is, there your heart is also.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right. God's your treasure.
If you treasure him, if you respect him, then your heart will be wanting to do.
Remember your creator. That's right. Be mindful of is really what it means. Remember your creator means be mindful of him. In other words, acknowledge the Lord in all your ways, and what will he do? Direct your path. If you'll just acknowledge him, be mindful of him, remember him in all your ways, he will direct where you go and what you do. You don't have to worry about it. See, worrying is the one thing he didn't say to do. In fact, it's the one thing he said, don't do. He didn't say, worry about what my will is. He said, just acknowledge me. Acknowledge my existence as your father, your loving father, who wants you to go the right path in all of your ways. And then I'll do my part. I'll direct your path. In this equation, nowhere does it say worry about what my path should be. He said, just acknowledge me. I'll direct you. That's it. Because he's a good shepherd. Amen? Doesn't he make that easy? And that's entering into the rest, isn't it? Takes anxiety and worry out of everything. It just deflates every argument and every inroad the enemy has. Amen? What a beautiful life God's laid out in front of us. So, any other thought? Yeah.
Just going back to verse 3, where he's talking about the grinders.
Mm-hmm.
The King James says teeth.
Teeth, does it? Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that would be the connection between the two. Yeah. And that's possible. I don't believe that's what it's referring to, especially in the first mention. In the second mention, I think it's a secondary mention. I think he's using molars, grinders, as the metaphor, and then the family who is distant and not there as the thing that eats away at you. Okay? The example being the molars, the metaphor being the molars, the truth being the other. Because again, and that was another thing that came up in my AI search, was the reason why I didn't believe the eyesight was being mentioned twice, with the windows being just purely about eyesight again, is because it would be a wasted metaphor. He's already wasted one metaphor on that. Why waste another one? It doesn't make sense. And it doesn't show progression. It shows going back to the beginning and where we started, which is why I don't think it has that meaning with teeth in two places either. It doesn't make sense. So, and like I said, in that search I did, they said, you're absolutely right that it would be a wasted metaphor. That's not consistent with Hebrew poetry. Hebrew poetry builds on itself. It doesn't go back and retrace its steps. So now it does if you're dealing with isolated parallelism, but this is too long to be an example of parallelism. So yeah, it's a progressive truth and therefore would not be fitting with Hebrew poetry. So I'm glad you brought that up. So anyone else? All right, well, then we're going to go ahead and close in prayer, but I'm going to go ahead and tell you, I don't know for certain, but as I was driving and praying today, I sensed that what we may do next, not as a permanent thing, but before we move on possibly to the New Testament, because there's a part of me that'd like to go ahead and go to the New Testament, because number one, it's going to be infinitely easier, because I go through the New Testament with you guys every year anyway. I don't think there's too many verses other than some in Revelation and some of the Gospels I miss. We cover pretty much every single, in Philemon. That's about it. I think most verses we cover almost every year in here in the New Testament. I mean, really, when you think about it, the New Testament, is a very tiny book. I mean, I don't mean to discourage people who are not fast readers, but really, it's a bathroom book. Yeah, it's the kind of thing you could literally sit and read most of it in one sitting, really. Certainly within a week of sitting on the John, you could read through the New Testament. It's a tiny book. I mean, it's this thick. You know, pamphlets are bigger than this. So it's not a big deal. But so I don't have any problem going through it, and I'd love to be able to add that to our Through the Bible, so it's completely complete. But I don't know for sure that we're going to do that, but I'd like to. But what I think that we are going to do before we do that is, number one, I'm encouraging you guys, please be people who are thoughtful and thinking about your faith enough to have questions. My suggestion box remains empty, and it has been empty for years. And it's there, because I told you a long time ago, that suggestion box is there, so that if there's a suggestion in it, one Wednesday of every month would be a teaching on what someone expressed an interest in knowing more about. That's part of my job as a shepherd, is to guide you in areas that you have questions about. That's part of my job. Well, I largely have got a toll-free job when it comes to that, because no one really asked me anything. So it's still there. And this would be a great time between old and new to do some of those, if you have anything in your head about it. Okay, so there you go. Just throwing it out there one more time. The other thing is, I think that what we might do is that now that we've completed it, is have a couple of Wednesdays, maybe two or three, that kind of do a recap that just show, this is what we covered. This is what these books were talking about. This is what these books were talking about. This is what these books were talking about. So that now you get an overview now that you've already gone all the way through it. Okay. And I think that it'll help you, because one thing that it's done for me, which I had a lot of this knowledge before I did it, but not nearly that I have now. I will be the first one to admit I have learned volumes in doing this since 2017, no doubt about it. But one thing that I have walked away so overly impressed by is how ridiculously short the Old Testament is. It's not short in words and verses. It's short in subjects. You can encapsulate everything it's talking about in about four or five events. It's not even covering that much. It's covering ridiculously literal. And being able to capture that in snapshots in your mind will help you put the Old Testament into segments, so that if you have a question, I wonder what, you pretty much have narrowed down where I can go without even have to have a search, on your phone or on a concordance. You could go right there, because you already know if this is talking about warnings about the Assyrian captivity, I know where to go, because I know what prophets talked about that. If this is talking about the Babylonian captivity, which is the only, you realize only two major captivities in the entire Bible, those two. Most of the Old Testament prophets are warning about one or the other. Did you realize that? Most of what they're talking about is just warning against those two things. So lots of words, two events. Are you hearing what I'm saying? That helps, doesn't it? So having these big categories to stick things in, I think, would probably help you. Okay, so I think that we might do that. It won't be anything we haven't already said, but it'll be stuff that dates far enough back that in the retelling of it, it'll put things in a category so that you can kind of put bookends in your brain. And you're like, this is what this is about. 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 And some of them have a little tiny bit of overlap. And I think that might help. I don't know I'm certain it will if you pay attention. I have no doubt it will help. So that's what I'm thinking that we will probably do in the next several weeks coming up. And I'll be monitoring the suggestion box. And if there are any, we'll cover some of those, one or two of those, before we launch into possibly going into the New Testament. Okay, so there we are. Let's go ahead. Yes, go ahead, Doris.
Got to mention that when you were first going through Ecclesiastes 11:9, you talked about have joy, O young man, and clarifying,
The audience,
the standard. I was curious. I went to the contemporary English version.
Mm-hmm.
It says it doesn't even mention any gender at all. It says be cheerful and enjoy life while you are young.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
so,
yeah,
anybody could take it as being, oh, that means anybody.
Yeah. And there's ways in which that's good and ways in which that's bad. I mean, it's good in some respects because of the fact that it does, the advice applies to anybody, old, young, male, female. It robs the Bible of its context and its history by not bringing that up, because it allows us to make assumptions of superimposing modern culture on ancient culture. It's always been this way, and it hasn't always been this way.
mean, that same verse that goes on says, do what you want and find pleasure in what you see, but don't forget that God will judge you for everything you do.
Yeah.
Nothing about motives or actions. Or
anything like that. Oh, wow. It doesn't even bring that up. Wow, that's scary.
For everything you do. That's why
Yeah. Yeah, there's
flinched a little bit.
Yeah, there's definitely some translations you have to be very careful about. I'm glad you brought that up. But yeah, I mean, I understand that the lack of education of the modern church is so profound that I understand those translations being helpful to get points. That having been said, I don't think you arrive at the best by lowering the bar. Mm-hmm. We've done that in schools, and that's just produced people who can't even read cursive anymore. And can't even understand what are, to you and I, not even big words, and to them, they're big words. What does that mean? I watched a video about that the other day. This young man who's brighter than most, he would be like, you know, the kind of, he's young, but he's got the intellect of people who went through school in our time. And he wrote out sentences in short front sentences, very short sentences in cursive, like the dog ran quick. Short sentences, and went out in public and showed to people his same age, and the greatest majority of them could not read them. They had no idea what they could make out a couple of words, but they had no idea what the phrase was actually saying. Some of the words were just, the letters were just so obscure to them, they had no idea. But mostly because, like, you know, Z is an odd shape in cursive, but these people can't read cursive. They were never taught. So it literally is a foreign language to them. You might as well be telling them. I mean, you know what Middle Eastern Iranian kind of language looks like. Arabic looks to us. It looks like scribbly lines, and that's what it looks like to them. English in cursive looks like, you know, Arabic to them. They don't know what that is. And but then he did another one with Cuba, a little 3x5 cards that had just a sentence that made sense. But used unusual words, but it was making a point, and they were kind of rhyming, and they were little tongue twisters. And the greatest majority of people couldn't get through it. Not only they couldn't even read it from one end to the other and get the words right, because they couldn't pronounce some of the slightly larger words, but they didn't know what it meant because they didn't know what that word was. And these people are college level now. That's a result of lowering the bar. Now, I only use that as an example of those people represent most people in the church. Most people in first world country churches are as dumb as those people trying to read a 3x5 card. The bar has been lowered so much that they don't get any point. And it has made, it's kicked the door wide open for all these weird variations of lifestyles. And I'm not talking about gay, though that's included. That's with the idea of, you know, the huge increase in feminism in the church and egalitarianism and female pastors and all that kind of stuff is because they took the word young man out and no one taught them and no one engaged them. And they did not have the encouragement or the desire to study to find out that this isn't just Jewish and they grew up in a patriarchal society because of the culture around them, but this was actually God's way that he instilled in them. Do you realize that the great majority of people in the church today believe that Jewish society, Jewish social life was largely influenced by their culture, not by God? Did you know that? They believe it's patriarchal because the whole earth was patriarchal back then. No, wait a minute. No. Everything God did, he did to make it so that Israel would stand out and aloof from the world. And yet he still had patriarchy there. Even though it agreed with the world, he couldn't change that just to make them different with the world. He made it because this is what's right. And that's not taught. And it's all like a big snowball, cumulative effect from little things like the one that Doris brought up. It no longer says young man, it says youth. Well, yes, that's good in one way because you see how it has an application to everybody. But boy, that's just one in a million stones that cause you to lose your bearings when it comes to do with what Scripture is really ultimately pointing at. Right? So it's been a great education going through the Old Testament. And I hope that I'm certain that you must have gotten a lot out of it. So let's go ahead and close it.
Grace. Grace.
Grace.
Grace.